Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use and cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Good morning, Howard. It is a pleasure to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have lots of mutual friends. We have been exchanging, electronic communications for quite some time, and we finally found some time to get together on the podcast and have a meaningful conversation. I'm delighted to have you here today. But before we jump into our topic of discussion, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Thank you, Jason. I'm really pleased that we're talking after all our other conversations and interactions. Thanks so much for inviting me. My name is Howard Lake, and I run the website UK Fundraising, which this month is 26 years old. So it was the first website for professional charity fundraisers, nonprofit fundraisers, with the aim of sharing fundraising news, ideas, expertise, with as wide an audience as possible, with as many different kinds of voices, all using the then new technology of digital, of the web, and so on. So my background is fundraising. It's all I've done for the last 32 years here in the UK. I was a student fundraiser at university. That's how I got the bug. And then worked for 9 years at Oxfam, GB, then as a sole fundraiser at Afghan Aid, which worked cross-border from Pakistan into Afghanistan, and then 5 years at Amnesty International UK. So that's my fundraising background. And then I set up when UK Fundraising, my website, was doing well, I spun that off as a separate company. So for the last 26 years or so, I've been running it as a commercial entity with training and consultancy involved, but all with a focus on digital, which is obvious now, but wasn't quite so obvious in 1994.
Yeah, I appreciated that. As I was looking at our show notes, Howard, and I was thinking about what this conversation was going to be, I was thinking about a writing project that I'm working on now, and I had to I thought, I'm going to ask him about this. How did you know in 1994? What was sort of that, what sort of struck you that you knew this was going to be, that digital was going to be bigger than it is, or as it is in 1994. In 1994, I was still in high school. So, I wasn't using email until college. So 3 years later. So what was it that happened in 94 that sort of said, this is actually going to mean something?
Fair enough. Yes, with hindsight, it all looks remarkably well planned, but needless to say, it wasn't. My background is medieval history. That's what I did at university. When I was at high school and university, there just were next to no computers. Certainly at high school, there was a computer, but it filled a whole room. So I'm of that age. And as a historian, computers weren't relevant to me. How it felt at the time. So what I did during the early 90s, I was a fundraiser. I'd got a degree, but I had no other commercial or academic background. So something made me recognize that I needed to get some kind of, well, we didn't call it digital, but sort of electronic or data qualification. So I went and did a part-time master's while I was at Amnesty fundraising, a part-time master's in information science. So not information technology, but information science, which is really the I in IT. It's the use of information, the provision of it, how it's structured, all that kind of stuff, which I assumed was going to become more important. You know, there were word processors around then. This was going to only ever grow. It was while I was doing that in about 1992, in the evenings, I got access to the World Wide Web, and it had capital letters in those days, and other information retrieval tools. And that just astonished me. And I just thought, wow, I really hope this can be applied to fundraising. How can it be? Who's doing it? And the fact that you could interact with other fundraisers around the world was astonishing. So I was talking, emailing in sort of 92, 93 with fundraisers, usually at US universities and Canadian ones as well, just because most universities had email in those days. And just learning lots of things like Nimkrutz and Kratz and all the sort of precursors to donor advice funds and all this stuff that just didn't exist in the UK. So I was learning a lot and just enjoying communicating. But my first experience of email was actually in 1989 in my first job. Wow. At Oxfam. So I was what they called an area fundraiser or assistant area fundraiser, which meant I did all the kind of community and events fundraising in three counties, so areas of the UK in and around Oxford and Oxfordshire. And Oxfam at that point was networking all its regional offices. So I was in this tiny little office and they had this fabulous computer, and I'd never really used a computer before. And it had email, and it meant, I worked out very quickly, I was curious, it meant that I could talk to other fundraisers in other parts of the UK and other shop fundraisers as well, because Oxfam has lots of shops for fundraising, charity shops, thrift shops. So that's how I got that. And I just, with absolutely no technology background, just an ability to type, that's where it all started. And I've never really looked back.
Howard, we always invite our guests to have a big idea or bold opinion, and I'm very excited. I've got a book I want to pull out. I grabbed it here a moment ago while you were talking because I want to reference it related to our conversation. But we always ask our guests to bring a big idea or bold opinion, and I'm eager to have this one. So what's our topic of conversation this morning?
I'm going to suggest we talk about the idea of growing giving on a massive scale. On a truly ambitious scale, because we need to, whether it's climate crisis or that's now been overtaken by COVID coronavirus, the nonprofit sector needs to be able to grow on a massive scale to deal with pressing emergency situation. All organizations are being affected by COVID. They are certainly going to be affected on an even bigger scale by climate crisis. And that's going to cost money to deal with.
You know, in the first reaction, I think given that what we're going to talk about, growing giving on a you know, massive scale and using digital technology to do that, I think has enormous potential. But the first question that came to mind as I was thinking about this is, I think some of us are going to have some major issues with how that's actually going to play out and work.
Yeah,
because I remember doing some research of my own some time ago, and it was this, and I often repeat this. It's the Wasserman at Harvard did a study where he came up with this general conclusion that's not terribly earth shattering or anything. The idea that there's an inverse relationship between growth and control. And if you're talking about growth, which is what you're referring to, somebody's going to have to relinquish control. Mm-hmm. And so what do you think? I mean, if whatever we're going to achieve, who's going to achieve it? And is it going to mess with all of us who have control issues?
I think it is. And you're right. I think, yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely the first to admit that when I suggest growing giving on a large, on a massive scale, it sounds unbelievably naive. The equivalent for me in the sort of 1980s as a fundraiser was, you know, people saying, oh, Howard, you're a fundraiser. Why don't you get Sting to put on a big concert for your charity? You think, yeah. Oh, come on. And it's sort of for, you know, most fundraisers at some point have been, you know, their friend or family has said, well, why don't you get in touch with Bill Gates? He's got quite a lot of money. It's kind of, I accept there's kind of naive activities there. All I'm thinking of is, and I will answer your question, but I'm thinking of at the moment, why has fundraising not been completely changed by what's happened in digital? And it's not a digital revolution, I accept an evolution, but you look at all the other industries that have been completely transformed. Finance, retail, employment, all kinds of things. The fundraising sector has changed, absolutely. Digital has really improved many things, but it really hasn't been changed. There's not a single digital charity that has completely displaced, you know, digital-only charity or digital-first that has just, you know, ripped up the rule book and yeah, probably displaced existing slower-moving organizations. Right. But you're right. I mean, just asking for more money may not actually be the right question. So that's probably the first weakness of my suggestion. Except I do know that the only change that happens in this world is through people and people with access to resources. So if you want massive change, there's going to be a cost to it somewhere. And that may well, yeah, shake the apple cart, and which may make it impossible. I absolutely accept that's possibly the most likely situation. We can only grow by a modest amount. Maybe that is the future.
So I have been, Howard, I have been reading, and you may be familiar with his book, The Seventh Sense, Power, Fortune, and Survival in the Age of Networks. Hmm. Gentleman Joshua Cooper Ramo is his name. And he talks about how this idea of the capabilities of networks and digital and everything that you're sort of alluding to is perhaps a potential for fundraising really comes down to a way of thinking and a sort of an intuitiveness. I mean, an instinct is probably a better word. Hmm. That we have to be sort of born of or develop a particular instinct, like the what he's referring to as the seventh sense during the sixth sense he's referring to back in the Enlightenment, and then leading into sort of the Industrial Revolution and what that meant in terms of our sense of how the world works. But what he's suggesting with this next seventh sense is the idea that We have to have an underlying way of sort of thinking about how all this works, which leads to the inevitable question for which is what you're sort of alluding to here. Do we as fundraising professionals sort of have that sense of how this would even work? If we looked at this suggestion of fundraising on a massive scale, is it in fact us as fundraisers who even have the capability or way of thinking to get that done?
Possibly. I think probably not that many. Most of us do have to just work, you know, it's day-to-day work. We need to hit the budget and consistently hit the budget. And we have internal issues and challenges. Absolutely. You know, we've all lived and worked through that. So yes, I can think of two possible solutions to where this sort of this massive growth might come. And I'm going to argue, accept, you know, all the stats suggest that there's only a certain amount. Average household giving income in the UK and the US just doesn't shift. In good times and in bad times. And I will let the economists explain why that might be so. But two possible approaches that may just shake, you know, some apples from the tree. One is, fundraisers who can see the restrictions on how they're being held back in what they might achieve. And 9 times out of 10, that's going to be other people. It could be the sector as a whole, or more identifiably, trustees, board members, you know, senior staff, whoever.
Yeah.
So they may well be able to see blockages And that's probably the place that we can probably unlock most income soonest. So I'm thinking in the UK, we have, having written my site for so many years, I'm perennially writing about the amount of gift aid. That's one of the tax effective methods of giving that all charities can benefit from in the UK. And typically about 10 years ago, it was £1 billion per year were going unclaimed in gift aid donations. So all charities had to do was fill in the form, and the IRS was going to just send the money, the additional 25% on each £1 donated. It's now down to about £600 million a year. So again, that's big. It's not massive in terms of the overall charitable income, charity sector income, but it's one set of effectively a blockage that I think some creativity and some focus could perhaps address. And if they'd addressed it 10 years ago, that's £10 billion, maybe more. So that's one option. The other is the slightly more, it's less likely, but equally exciting possibility of the change actually happening in another industry. And then someone in that industry with any luck, or possibly someone in the nonprofit industry, spotting the application of that. So again, I can't tell you what it is. Maybe it's, a financial instrument, a really sort of clever use of digital to apply to people's accounts. It could be, the equivalent of the Robin Hood tax. Remember, there were efforts some years ago to try and put an absolutely minute tax on all financial transactions around the world, a penny, a cent on each transaction, which would hardly cost anyone anything, but overall would develop into a massive fund, which could be used for social good. Again, it's big picture. That didn't work out. There may be very good reasons why it didn't. But there are these sort of external initiatives that may hold the key. And I'm the first to admit I don't have the answer. The only solution for any massive giving is going to come from a consortium of individuals, ideally with very diverse backgrounds. And that's another element of this, which I accept makes it more difficult. Knowing the makeup of traditional nonprofit charity and fundraising leaders, we know we are not representative of society at all. So actually, go on.
Maybe you and I can figure this out.
I'd like to.
Maybe you and I can get credit for figuring some of it out. I do think, Howard, I tend to be the guy who likes to think in theory and very sort of systems level. And so when I think about what you're talking about, I think about first thing that comes to mind is I think what actually is going to happen. I agree with the sort of the later point. I think that somebody in another industry, another space is going to, and I'm sure these what we might call platforms sort of already exist, and they're going to see the application to the charitable sector and see its potential, and they're going to apply it, and it's going to work remarkably well. I think it's going to, and perhaps, and I think I've had other guests sort of allude to the same idea, that something's going to sort of surprise us, and perhaps very serendipitously in terms of our ability to raise funds, but not so much in the sense of us getting credit as fundraisers for figuring it out. But I think the other thing is I think that we have to be open to a very distributed sort of approach to whatever this is. And I think that's part of the underlying challenge is that the charity sector, the nonprofit sector is organized as these sort of isolated institutions that are largely designed for control. And centralized control, whereas I think the scale that generally we see of anything happening, it's distributed. There is no sort of central command center, if you will. But something else comes to mind too, and I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on this along the same lines, is that we're actually talking. So I think what is so fascinating about digital. I think what fascinates us so much, Howard, is that digital allows us to spread information so quickly, so quickly and so broad, so widely, that I think in some ways we think that it can also spread behavior. And when we talk about charitable giving, we're actually talking about spreading, you know, compelling behavior differently than information. So it's one thing for you and I to both get on Facebook, for example, and both have a similar idea and write about it and then hashtag it and get it to go all over the world. It's a completely another thing to actually change human behavior, which is a couple of steps down the road when it comes to what it is we humans do. Am I right?
You're right. Absolutely. I mean, it's not a technological solution. You're right. It's not a new platform. It's not a new, you know, financial channel or anything that is going to make the change. It's people, it's organizations, and it may not be nonprofits or charities because of, as you say, their sort of command and control structure. That may be a hindrance on us. Does that mean we have to do away with them? We can't overnight, but yeah, maybe the actual growth, the massive growth comes from a different structure of organization. It may even be a sort of social enterprise or even a sort of, you know, a for-profit that is, you know, socially based, you know, sort of B Corp or something. But yeah, it's behavior, but in a way I'm going to flip that over and say that is quite a positive element.
Yes.
Human behavior doesn't change, but we know how much people want to give. I mean, that's what we live with as fundraisers. People will give if they're presented with the compelling reason, and it's easy. So yeah, I agree. There is that real big challenge, but it's people rather than tech. But tech's going to do the heavy lifting.
You've been looking. One of the things I'm working on, I've been researching this for quite some time, and you may have seen this in some of the things that you all talk about in the United Kingdom. Is this idea that we have, and this may be a bunny trail and sort of totally throw off the conversation, but I'm interested in your thoughts as it applies to what we're talking about, that we have mistakenly sort of boxed in the identity of the donor with that of the consumer. And I know that to be true here in the United States, that a lot of the way that we approach fundraising, it's just like the consumer and the donor are sort of one and the same. And so whatever tactics, whatever methods, whatever underlying assumptions that would perhaps compel or motivate that scale that you're talking about assumes basically consumer behavior, the same way that we would buy and sell goods at the local, you know, retail store or grocery store or something, the way we buy and sell automobiles or cell phones or something. Would you say that's true in the UK as well, that the sort of the identity of that massive scale capability is going to essentially come through the assumption that we're all consumers, or can we actually see the donor as someone else?
Yeah, it's a challenging issue. It's that approach, the idea of seeing donors as consumers, or maybe even ethical, stroke, social, whatever, consumers, has driven and resulted in nonprofits operating on a massive scale. The whole of my career, you know, 30 years, that has been the model. So the use of trading, of charitable shops, the use of direct marketing, whether print, whether digital, absolutely, it's donor as consumer. So I absolutely recognize the value of that and what that's enabled charities to do on a much grander scale. Is it that simplistic? No. I know there are various books on the topic. Is it sustainable? It's if on the grounds that consumerism is possibly not in its current format, it needs adapting. Yeah, you could argue that charities or social enterprises may well have to be in the sort of vanguard of changing that approach, or at least accepting it's not quite the precise overlay. But yeah, that gets out of my area, I have to admit.
My 18-year-old, I have an 18 and a 16-year-old, my two older children. And the other day we were talking about Christmas gifts, and they have watched their parents for years. Christmas is always a hustle and bustle, sort of sometimes stressful time. And they basically said to me and their mother, we don't really care to do the gift exchange this year. And it occurs to me that sort of when we think of consumerism, like my 16 and my 18-year-old children, the identity as consumers essentially sort of goes out of vogue. At some point, we've sort of consumed enough, and that impulse to sort of buy more and you know, consume, it sort of reaches a peak. And I wonder if the idea that you're getting at, Howard, is on the other side of that. if in some way consumption, the idea that, that our consumer society is what has driven the scale that we've achieved in fundraising thus far, has essentially put constraints on it. And that if we got outside that box and we thought of the human impulses that sort of extend beyond the idea to sort of buy and sell goods, could the answer to your question sort of be hiding on the other side of that? Do you follow what I'm thinking?
I do. The only downside about that is, as fundraisers, we know we need to generate income now, tomorrow, next week, and so on. So I think that may be the case. And in a way, that sounds quite utopian, wonderful, less consumerism, but more social engagement or application of people's wealth and time and skills. It might be. And in which case, yeah, this is not going to happen for a while, if at all. I think what I've tried to focus on is just to try and find ideas, people, that are looking at the situation as it is now. We have to work with what we've got. Certainly there is an absolute emergency. There's a urgency in terms of time to deal with some of these issues. So in a way, we can't quite wait to see how society pans out. And yes, the fabulous attitudes of your children. With any luck, yeah, that will drive change.
Might give some clues. Now, you all have some stories. I don't think we have the stories that you all have had over in the United Kingdom, but you've had a couple of these examples recently. Perhaps for the sake of our listeners, maybe a couple of them come to mind, Howard, where you've had extraordinary responses that sort of extend beyond the norm, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Certainly in this year, we've seen astonishing reactions, which again just show that people will give, even in a recession or even in the depression. I know I've read stories about giving during the depression in the US and in the UK. People always give, which at the time, if you're a fundraiser who just is absolutely struggling to reach your budget, it's almost painful to know that there are people willing to give and you haven't yet found them. But still, so yeah, I think the case you're probably referring to is Captain Tom.
Captain Tom.
He's just an astonishing chap who, yeah, was just wanted to do a fundraising event to help our National Health Service, our hospital network, and people who work there. And it's just one of those odd occasions where there are probably many other people who've done something like that, but somehow he managed to capture the public attention. He did it very quickly during our first lockdown, limited access to get outside with shops closed and so on. And I think it was just the unusualness, but his sort of, there was an element of his personality that helped. I'm sure his family had, you know, media contacts or something, and that's why he stood out rather than others. But yes, he went on to raise the largest amount that an individual has raised, I think in the shortest time. I'm top of my head, I'm going to say about £32 million pounds, so whatever that is, kind of high 30s in terms of dollar donations. Just astonishing. And he's gone on to do more. That's the weird thing, or fabulous thing. He's, you know, he's written a book. He set up a charitable foundation now as well. And the important thing about him was that when he started walking around his garden 100 times, that was what he set himself to do as a sponsored challenge, a sponsored event. He was 99, and he was very near, 99 years old, and he was very, very near to approaching his 100th year. So that really cemented, I think, his the affection that many people felt for him and the willingness to support. And there are people even now replicating what he did. I came across, I think 2 weeks ago, there was a 6-year-old boy who has dressed up to look like Captain Tom to do his fundraising event. Right. So there's just this whole sort of tribe of people who've been inspired by this one amazing man. Who, you know, whose kind of whole life's ambition, in a way, or sort of the impact he's made, waited until he was 99 to do it.
And there's the story, refresh my memory, the story, the comedian who raised a bunch of money for the Australian fires, didn't she do something similar? I think it ruffled a little more feathers than this story did, but
yes,
what's the narrative behind that one?
I can't remember the details on that one. I remember lots of that happening. I remember there being issues about one of the challenges. So the downside of that was one. I think if it's the same person, the downside was in terms of using
how you move the money or something.
Yes. If it, again, as all fundraisers know, if you state what you're going to spend the money on, you have to do that, and it gets.
But,
tricky.
Even she raised remarkable amounts of money, yes. But in both cases, you're talking about two people who would not necessarily have identified themselves as quote unquote fundraisers. No. I'm reminded of, Henry Timms and a co-author of his wrote a book called, I'm sure you're familiar with the book, New Power.
Yes.
And he talks about in that book, and I know he's large, and this is for the sake of our listeners, he's one of the co-founders of Giving Tuesday. He uses the same word you just did as you were describing Captain Tom, that a lot of these things, a lot of this new power is in the power of the individual to sort of utilize the infrastructure, the Facebooks and the, you know, all the digital platforms that we have access to. And that a lot of this massive scale may come as a result of the institution, I mean, of the individual rather than the institution. Which I think gets back to what I was saying a moment ago about control. The institutions are oftentimes designed for control. And the individuals are oftentimes perhaps more oriented towards growth, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the big change is always brought by an individual or ideally a small group of individuals.
Yes.
Yeah. Jeremy Hyman's the co-author. Absolutely.
Yes,
I've seen him speak. It's people with that idea or people who can tap into a change or perhaps a hunger in public attitude, I think, are the ones that are likely to change it. So, yeah, I just want to suggest I'm not the sort of tech evangelist or naive person. It's people and ideas that will change this and perhaps unlock bigger or new sources of income rather than the tech itself.
And we've had people in the United States, and you folks have certainly experienced them in the United Kingdom too. It's also the idea of sort of moving towards movements.
Yeah.
One of my colleagues really likes to put the word movement behind things, and I certainly understand where that is coming from, is because I think people are seeing change come as a result of movements.
Hmm. I think that's true. I think in many ways, fundraisers at more perhaps traditional nonprofits have a lot to learn from the advocacy or their colleagues at advocacy organizations. It's finding like-minded people, but also people tend to, for good or ill, tend to stick with people or even live in areas of people with very similar backgrounds, as we know. So yes, I think movements truly do matter. I agree with it. I just wonder whether it's kind of the latest sort of curve or latest idea. But I think it has legs. It seems to me quite a compelling approach to find and build a movement so that it's not just the organization. The organization is in the background. It's the numbers of people and their activism and their giving on a massive scale that drives change, I hope.
So, Howard, I have had your attention for a half hour. Our listeners have held on with this, but I've got to hear the Curry House's story. One of the questions I asked, tell us about an interesting sort of experience. And you reference Curry Houses needing websites, but maybe not charities. Can you tell us that story?
That goes back to trying to get funding for my company and my website back in 1996, I think, when I was actually setting up the company to run the site. I went to one of the big four banks it was in central London. And even worse, I can remember it was my birthday, so this is why it's stuck in my head. and I was just asking for a very modest amount of money to buy a computer or sort of some very basic office equipment to run my website permanently. And I remember the bank manager who was in charge of deciding whether I was going to get a loan just looked at me and said, no, that just doesn't mean anything to me. We know that curry houses, Indian restaurants, they need websites. I've seen one or two of them.
Right.
But no, the charity sector and fundraisers, they'll never need websites. Why won't you? So I'm sorry, Mr. Lake, but no. But hey, like all good fundraisers, we pick ourselves up and we go and do it differently.
And that's an interesting place to wrap up, because isn't that in some ways the underlying challenge that we have too, is that the private sector can largely, the commercial side of the world can largely prop up sometimes anything, in that we charities struggle to just get the minimal support that we need to prop up big ideas.
Yeah.
So that's certainly a humorous but very wonderful way to wrap this up. Howard, if one of our listeners is listening, they want to reach out to you, perhaps they have some ideas about how to achieve this scale that we're talking about? How would you suggest that they reach out to you?
I would love to hear from anyone who's thinking or working around that area. That would be lovely. My website is fundraising.co.uk, and I'm at Howard Lake on Twitter. So I'd be delighted to hear or even just chat with anyone else. So thank you.
It's certainly been a pleasure, Howard. You're always welcome back.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.